search that Denali Pass area and then move down further into what a likely fall line would have been from the Autobahn.
The National Park Service recovers the body of a climber high up on Denali. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation prepares for another round of layoffs.
We didn't meet our revenue collection goals since late 2012, and so that's had a huge impact to decrease our revenue.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Thread joins working families across Alaska in wishing early care and education professionals a happy Provider Appreciation Day. Thank you for your contribution to delivering quality care in Alaska and for your hard work in preparing young children for the future. To learn more about early care and education in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread.
Just days into climbing season, a mountaineer has died in an accident on Denali. 39-year-old Sylvia Montag of Tacoma, Washington, became separated from her climbing partner before falling nearly 1,000 feet. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Sylvia Montag and her climbing partner, Mike Fox, a 34-year-old mountaineer from Berlin, Germany, were climbing near Denali Pass on May 3rd at just over 18,000 feet when the weather forced them to turn away from the summit and set up camp to shelter from the high winds. After waiting out the weather for 2 days, Montag and Fox began their descent down the west buttress of Denali. During the expedition, Mike Fox updated a blog on the pair's progress. The last entry in the blog is from the night of May 4th. Mike Fox described winds over 60 miles an hour and temperatures lower than 10 degrees below zero. He noted that the pair was down to about 3 days of food. That was probably enough to descend the mountain, but it likely ruled out any further summit attempts. At 11 a.m. on Monday, May 5th, the National Park Service says that Fox reported via satellite phone that he and Montag had become separated and both had limited supplies, but he did not request a rescue. Fox had taken shelter in a storage locker kept at high camp around 17,200 feet. On Tuesday, May 6th, Fox called the National Park Service again to request a helicopter rescue. He said he still had not heard from Montag. Maureen Galtieri, spokeswoman for Denali National Park, says that the phone calls as well as the blog provided useful information for rescue personnel.
That helped the rangers here kind of establish a timeline, how they were acclimatizing, where, you know, they had spent certain nights, and that information was helpful in kind of figuring out where we're at, how much food they might have left, what kind of equipment are in. Even more than that, maybe some of the apparel they were wearing. If we were going to go do an aerial search, we would know what we were looking for.
High winds and poor visibility prevented the Park Service from launching its rescue helicopter on Tuesday. Because Montag and Fox were climbing very early in the season, mountaineering rangers were not yet in position to help on the ground either. On Wednesday morning, the weather cleared enough for the rescue helicopter to launch. Dave Weber is a mountaineering ranger for the Park Service and was on board the helicopter.
The information we were going on from her climbing partner was that the most likely last known spot was up in that Denali Pass at around 18,200 feet. And that's the beginning of on the descent portion of the Autobahn area that takes you down to 17,200 camp. And so we searched that Denali Pass area and then moved down further into what a likely fall line would have been from the Autobahn.
Montag's remains were spotted between 800 and 1,000 feet below the normal trail used on the traverse known as the Autobahn. The Park Service believes she fell while descending from the pass sometime on May 5th. The area where Montag fell is one of the more dangerous areas of the mountain. 12 people have died in similar accidents near the same spot in the last 70 years. Montag and Fox were not roped together while descending through the dangerous terrain. While that is not necessarily an uncommon practice, Dave Weber says the Park Service generally advises against it. Weber also says that descending through the area early in the season poses extra risks.
Earlier in the season, we tend to have icier conditions up high, so the footing is much more difficult. It's nearly impossible to self-arrest with your axe if you do start to slip or if you do fall. And so given that, we're very, very adamant that people take great caution and use protection along that traverse.
Before they're allowed to attempt Denali, climbers must check in with the ranger station in Talkeetna and receive a briefing that covers the risks and features of the mountain. Dave Weber says that Fox and Montag's briefing did not give any indicators that they were unprepared for the climb.
Looking at their resumes, they did seem to have the appropriate experience to be on a mountain like Denali. They seemed to be a pretty well-suited pair for this.
Mike Fox was rescued from high camp on Wednesday and flown first to base camp and later Talkeetna. The atmosphere at the Walter Harper Talkeetna Ranger Station was somewhat subdued on Friday. The sense is that everyone there hopes that this first climbing tragedy of 2014 is also the last. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Republican Senate candidate Joe Miller did something unusual yesterday. He spoke out in support of a party that was not his own. The comments concerned the Libertarian Party, which could be in a position to gain converts from some dissidents within the state GOP. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
As the state's biggest organized political party, the GOP represents plenty of different sects. There are big businessmen and small businessmen, religious conservatives, Tea Partiers, and a slew of other subgroups. The state's Libertarian Party is not so big. It has just a few thousand members. But there may be a perk to that. With fewer members, you can have more cohesion. Here's Libertarian Party Vice Chair Brad Levitt.
It's obvious the GOP is fractured. Everyone's well aware of that. And yeah, to be honest, we're reaping the benefits. People are coming over, and they're disgruntled.
Levitt says he's one of those guys. He only joined the Libertarian Party a year ago, and he often voted for Republican candidates before that. Now, Levitt says he's seeing more interest in his party from the Ron Paul faction of the GOP. In 2012, that group took over the GOP in a coup, but then lost control a year later to the establishment wing. Because the Republican Party and the Libertarian Party platforms have a lot of things in common, Levitt sees the organization appealing to some who feel marginalized as a Republican. And one of the biggest position differences between the two parties was recently taken out by the Libertarians. Where the Republicans have an anti-abortion plank in their platform, the Libertarian position had been that government should stay out of abortion. Levitt says the decision to remove it from the platform was
to make it an individual choice, be it the individual's decision one way or another, and the same for the candidate. Not pigeonholing the candidate to say, you must be this way or you must be that way. It's about liberty.
That could make his party more friendly to some of the Republican dissidents, including one big one, Joe Miller. A U.S. Senate candidate in a three-way Republican primary, Miller has had a strained relationship with the Alaska GOP over the years. While he has said he has no intention of running as anything but a Republican, Miller also rejected a pledge to support his Senate rivals if he loses the primary. This week, Miller raised eyebrows when he sent out a press release criticizing Mark Begich for remarks the Democratic senator made about libertarians in an interview. Miller argued that Begich was misrepresenting the Libertarian Party for political benefit, and Miller also stated he was proud to share values with the Alaska Libertarian Party. While Miller was traveling on Friday and could not be reached, Levitt says there is no arrangement for Miller to run as a Libertarian should the Republican bid fail. But the Libertarian Party is open to the idea.
We'd entertain it. We'd talk with him. We'd see what his thoughts and intentions are.
The Alaska Republican Party is not so open to this. Party Chair Peter Goldberg says the whole strategy would be self-defeating for conservatives.
If one of the losers of the Republican primary tries to run anyway, it will hurt the winner of the Republican primary. Surely some votes will move. And if it's just enough, that means Begich wins again.
Goldberg adds that his party has space for libertarian-minded members. The Libertarian Party still has not named its Senate candidate. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a grassroots effort to keep drugs out of Sandpoint.
I'm hopeful that the community is making a turn towards being more healthy.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Thank you.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation officials announced layoffs this week due to a $12 million budget shortfall. It's the second round of cuts in less than a year. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
After a recent audit of the organization, CEO Dan Winkleman realized it would take dramatic measures to get the organization that delivers health care to Bethel and surrounding villages back in the black.
According to our audited financials, which just came out, we lost almost $12 million last year in 2013. That's not sustainable, and we've had to make a budget correction because of that.
Winkleman says 110 employees will be let go across departments, and 50 more vacant positions will not be filled. YKHC consists of a regional hospital in Bethel, 9 regional facilities, and 47 village clinics. The corporation employs around 1,500 people and has an annual payroll of $70 million. Last fall, around 50 positions were cut. Winkleman, who took over as CEO about 3 months ago, says the budget shortfall is a result of several factors.
We didn't meet our revenue collection goals since late 2012, and so that's had a huge impact to decrease our revenue. Also, the federal sequester that occurred last year, that's affected us, and that decreased Indian Health Services budget. Therefore, it decreased our budget as well.
Winkleman says YKHC does not plan to lay off any doctors, but reductions will be made company-wide, and village clinics will be impacted.
Human Resources is going to be working with our managers to determine that. This is going to take approximately 30 days, the next 30 days, to implement. It's a large layoff, so it's going to take quite a bit of administrative time to complete it. Individual employees are going to be notified June 2nd through the 6th, so the first week of June, and we'll go from there.
$40 million in Indian Health Service settlement money recently awarded to YKHC for unpaid contract support services between 2005 and 2011 will not be used to shore up the budget, Winkleman says. Instead, he and the YKHC board are safeguarding that money for the future.
We're thinking out long-term, and part of our long-term strategy is to use those funds in addition to some other funds to try to get us a new hospital here as well as a new primary care center.
The new settlement money will be added to an investment account containing $40 million from a previous IHS settlement. With the layoffs, a spokesperson for YKHC says patients can expect a decrease in access to appointments, longer wait times, and fewer services. Winkleman says even with the cuts, he projects YKHC will lose over $3 million this year. However, he does not anticipate any more layoffs at this time. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A man allegedly carrying black tar heroin was arrested as he stepped off a plane in Sand Point last month. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
22-year-old Gage Carlson is facing two felony charges after his April arrest, one for transporting heroin with intent to sell it and another for possession of oxycodone. Carlson has been in custody in Anchorage, pending another hearing in Sand Point District Court this week. He was allegedly carrying 7 grams of black tar heroin when he arrived in town. Police Chief John Lucking says that would fetch anywhere from $14,000 to $28,000 on the street. They're still investigating others who might be connected to Carlson's case. Lucking says it's part of slow but steady progress in combating Sandpoint's drug problem. For one thing, he says police have seen an increase in tips about suspected drugs or drug dealers coming into town. That lets them make arrests before suspects even enter the airport. He says they have Sandpoint's grassroots anti-drug group Reclaim Alaska to thank for the upsurge of community involvement. Tiffany Jackson is the chair of that group, which is less than a year old. As far as she knows, none of their volunteers were involved in this latest investigation. Jackson says the bust is a good sign, but it also shows that substance abuse is still an issue in town.
But I'm hopeful that the community is making a turn towards being more healthy. There seems to be a positive response when we hear that less drugs are making it into the community. And there's less opportunity for people who have addictions to have access to them.
Reclaim Alaska's volunteers are also working on promoting healthy choices among local youth. They held two Reclaim Days at Sandpoint School this past semester, teaching students about the dangers of drug abuse and getting them involved in spreading the anti-drug message. Now the group is brainstorming ways to do more.
It'd be nice if we could figure out some way to formalize the organization, get some support to help move its mission forward.
Jackson hopes some of that support will come through grants, but she says Reclaim Alaska prides itself on what's been done without any funding, especially considering what they're up against. Sandpoint is a remote community with a transient population and a long-standing issue with heroin and meth. Jackson says for residents to organize is a big step forward.
I think the reason it's been successful so far is that it took community members in Sandpoint saying, regardless of the money that's available, we've had enough. We need to take our community back. We need to make this a safe place for our families, for our children, for our future, for right now, and taking a stand.
That started even before Reclaim Alaska came together, when a group of Sandpoint residents ran a suspected drug dealer out of town. They met the man at the airport last August and bought him a one-way ticket back to Anchorage. Jackson says Reclaim Alaska formed in the wake of that incident, and she says they don't condone vigilantism, but they are working with other communities like Dillingham and Bristol Bay to spread the idea that activism is possible, even without resources. At home in Sandpoint, Jackson says her ultimate goal is a totally drug-free community.
I think that it would be difficult to truly achieve, but it's something that we absolutely work towards. I mean, the more people that are knowledgeable of what's going on, of resources available to them to make any sort of healthy change or choice in their life, the better.
Reclaim Alaska has the support of police, local government, and neighboring communities in that mission. Jackson says they'll keep chipping away at it, one step at a time. In on Alaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks Mining Extension Program will offer a basic prospecting class in Palmer tomorrow. Dave Wright has worked on recreational and commercial mining claims for more than 30 years and will teach Saturday session. He says the day-long class will have broad appeal to both the weekend gold pan crowd as well as those looking to make it a business. Wright says Alaska is endowed with some of the richest mineral deposits in the world, and it's not just gold and copper.
There are opals being mined at one area of Alaska. Diamonds have been found, although as of yet nothing significant enough to mine, but diamonds are here. Emeralds exist in Alaska, and the possibility of a real good emerald find is not beyond reach.
Tomorrow's class will be at the Kurtula Hall in Palmer. You can register online. Links are at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Emily Schwing. This week on AK, plastics. Some say after climate warming, plastic is the biggest environmental problem we face. And unlike climate warming, no one argues over who's responsible for the plastic in our oceans. We are. After researching and reporting on the problem, Johanna Urich wanted to do her part to reduce plastic trash. She started at home in her tiny log cabin in Spinard and quickly discovered it's a daunting task.
One plastic-lined cat food can.
I'm sorting my trash and logging the plastic that's come into my life this week. It's all packaging. When I was born, there was very little plastic around. Now, more than half a century later, there's tons of it floating around the world's ocean. Most of it comes from land, and it's stuff from our cupboards and trash bins.
What is this? Bag for brown rice.
Unlike the long molecules that nature makes, The plastic we produce lasts forever. None of it rots the way natural cellulose does. Instead, it breaks down into smaller, less visible pieces and becomes even more dangerous in the environment. Some of Alaska's most remote beaches are covered with confetti of it. This is ridiculous. The plastic issue makes me confront the limits of consumer choice. What I can easily, I'm already doing. For example, we don't use plastic shopping bags anymore. But I still suffer from plastic guilt. Then I meet someone like Kylie Singh, working at the Alaska Center for the Environment. She comes at the plastic issue from a public health perspective.
I just continually was trying to wrap my head around something that we had just created, like plastic water bottles. If I was drinking out of a plastic water bottle and stashing it in my car for weeks at a time, I lived in the desert, there's got to be something leaching out of that plastic.
She was in college when she got to help lead an effort to stop the use of bottled water on campus.
A year after I graduated, we found out that we had lobbied hard enough to put the ban on bottled water at Humboldt State. And so we became the first public university to ban plastic bottled water on campus.
My plastic campaign isn't all doom and gloom. Some of it's fun. I'm making yogurt in a glass jar, so I don't have to buy the stuff in the plastic containers. The result is cheaper and tastier. I wrap the jar of lukewarm milk with a spoonful of yogurt in it and put it in the oven to incubate. The old pilot light keeps it warm. Every little bit helps.
Oh, this is the plastic packaging for the tiffin we bought so we wouldn't have to use plastic packaging for takeout food.
Dave Bass takes his own containers to restaurants when he buys takeout. He remembers the reaction the first time.
The person that took the containers wasn't sure it was even an option. They had to go check with somebody in the back and see if that was possible. They were a little confused, but they eventually did it.
Now local restaurants expect Dave to show up a few minutes early with glass Tupperware. It doesn't save a ton of trash, but he says the thought of the unnecessary styrofoam used to make it hard to take his food to go.
The tastiness and the convenience is nearly overshadowed by being forced to accept responsibility for several stupid styrofoam containers that are going to be floating around the ocean for the next billion years.
When I lived off the road system, everything came wrapped in plastic. That's why rural dumps are stuffed with plastic. We bury it and hope for the best. But the amount in village dumps pales compared to the quantities that wash up on our shores from Asia.
We're working on shorelines now that have up to 30 tons of plastic per mile on them.
Chris Pallister at Gulf of Alaska Keeper thinks the price of plastic should include all the external costs, including cleaning it up.
Other things like glass will be cost-effective then. We can just make it here and reuse it here.
Finally, I want to show you where I go when the plastic gets overwhelming. Welcome to my garden compost heap. This is the Temple of Rot, and my husband, Stephen, is the priest. He waters it and turns it to make it heat up.
It's starting to work. Steam starts coming out.
Compost is entropy transformed and transcended. The heroes are worms and microbes. They break down and recycle all the long molecules made by nature, even the stuff that makes us. We will all rot someday. If I'm lucky, my chemistry will make more food, more blossoms, like the sweet black compost from this heap.
See, it's smelling good now.
After we are all long gone, the plastic we made will still be here. It's a huge and growing pile, and there are no simple answers. All I can do is start with my own pile and look for others willing to do the same.
What have we here? A plastic bag. It just rises to the top.
I'm Johanna Urich.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're headed to Pelican in southeast Alaska on Chichagof Island.
My name is Patricia Phillips. I'm mayor for the city of Pelican. My husband and I have a commercial fishing business, the fishing vessel Pacific Dawn, and we longline for halibut and black cod. Only two ways to get here is by air or by sea. So if you come in on your boat or you come in on the ferry, you come up this long, narrow inlet that's about 20 miles long, and there are steep mountains on each side. You come around this point of land, and there's pelican nestled in the mountainside. And most of it's boardwalk community. We do have a flat area where the Pelican Creek runs through and where we have our hydroelectricity. We have a commercial fishing fleet. Right now there's some spring king salmon fishing going on, and mostly trollers are based out of our community. We do have some longliners that base themselves out of our community, but they end up having to sell their fish elsewhere. We have the world-famous Rosie's Bar, and we have Breesman's package license for liquor, and then we have Inlet Cafe. What do we do for fun? Well, it depends on who you ask, actually. We have the guys. The guys are always into hunting and fishing and going out on the boat. And then we have the gals who have a local craft group that they do, like, knitting and quilting. And we have a little library, so we do a lot of reading. And we have a lot of satellite internet, so that's how we stay connected to the outside world. There's gardening and, just the normal everyday stuff. But because we don't have a grocery store except for seasonally in our community, subsistence hunting and fishing, not only is it a necessity, but it's an enjoyment as well. And it's just a beautiful place to live.
Patricia Phillips is mayor of Pelican. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Johanna Yurick, Jolene Almendarez, Annie Fite, and Monica Goki. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Thread joins working families across Alaska in wishing early care and education professionals a happy Provider Appreciation Day. Thank you for your contribution to delivering quality care in Alaska and for your hard work in preparing young children for the future. To learn more about early care and education in Alaska, visit threadalaska.org. This message sponsored by Thread. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.